Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 24, Odyssey, Odyssey. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. Today's guest geek of the week is Chris Kyriakakis, CTO of Odyssey and Associate Professor of Audio Signal Processing at the USC Viterbi School of Engineering. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You bet. My pleasure. Before we get started, I wanted to make sure that those who are watching the video stream or logged into the chat room can post questions for Chris, and I will pass on as many as I can to him. So keep that in mind as you're watching us do our thing. And if you have a question, please feel free to post it there, and we'll see if we can get Chris to discuss whatever it is you have on your mind. What I've got on my mind is Chris's company, Odyssey, makers of a wide variety of audio signal processing technologies that are now found in many different products, consumer products, ranging from receivers to televisions. I think you're in televisions, aren't you?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And a variety of other audio-type products. So give us a quick rundown on how you started Odyssey with, I believe, Tom Holman, who was my very first guest on the podcast.
Yes, that's right. So in 1996, the National Science Foundation, which is a government research funding organization, awarded a very large grant to the University of Southern California, and it was to establish an engineering research center. This is the largest award you can get from the National Science Foundation. And so there were a number of faculty involved, and Tom and I were two of them. We're both colleagues there. Tom is in the School of Cinema, and I'm in the School of Engineering. And at that time, we established the Immersive Audio Laboratory, a research lab to look at various aspects of audio signal processing and the intersection of audio with how we perceive audio, which is psychoacoustics, and how room acoustics plays a role. So we were looking at research in the intersection of those three fields. And by 2002, we had done quite a bit of research in various of these topics and had come up with what we thought was technology that was good enough to commercialize. And so we spun out Odyssey out of the university in the summer of 2002. And by 2004, had the first product, which was MultiQ, appear in one Denon receiver, the 5805. That was our entry into the market in December of 2004. Since then, as you mentioned, we've expanded our offerings. Now, the majority of the home theater receivers have some sort of room correction, and I'm happy to say that a lot of them have Odyssey. But we've also gone into other areas like automobiles and televisions, and we can talk more about what we do there. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, in the past few years, we've also developed other technologies that go beyond the initial one.
Now, MultiQ is a room correction technology which automatically sets up your receiver, let's say, mostly I think it's in receivers, to take into account the room acoustics that you find yourself in, because all rooms are different, so you need to do some tweaking if you want to get the most sound quality out of your system. Can you explain basically how it works?
Yeah. So the way this started was when I was faculty, the first thing that a faculty has to do is to work towards getting tenure, and that means exactly. So to publish original work, you have to come up with original problems, and who best to go to for original problems than your colleague, Tom Holman, who's in the next office. And he said, well, try to solve the problem that I've been solving manually for the past 20 years, which is I walk into a room with analog equalizers and real-time analyzers and put up a bunch of microphones and take several hours to tune a theater to fix the acoustics. Can you figure out how to do that automatically? You won't solve it, but you'll get some good papers out of it.
So and maybe tenure.
That and maybe tenure, exactly. So that was Tom's challenge. I was very fortunate to have a great PhD student, Sunil Baritkar, who is a mathematician, who was interested in this work. And together we worked on a solution that tries to do this automatically. And the first part of this is to understand how to measure what's going on in the room. Because as you said, every room is different. Everywhere you place your loudspeakers causes different problems in that room. And so we had to understand what were the limitations of previous methods in measuring room acoustics and what we could do to change that. And one of the first things that we found was that it wasn't sufficient to use the traditional methods of pink noise that kind of give you a frequency response jumping around on your screen, because by the time you look at that, all of the bad things that are going to happen in the room have already happened.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, so when sound leaves the loudspeaker, some of it comes directly to you. That's the shortest path from
right. The
speaker to your ear. A lot of it, though, doesn't come directly to you. It'll bounce off your table, off the sidewalls, the ceiling, the floor, and those distances are a little bit longer. And so you get copies of the original signal arriving at your ears at different times, slightly later than the original.
Mm-hmm.
When they all arrive in your ear, your brain integrates all of those arrivals. And that causes a kind of distortion. It's what we call acoustic distortion. So it causes a smearing of transient, like guitar plucks or drums. It causes the voice maybe to sound comb filter. It causes other problems at low frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So by looking at just the frequency response, you have no chance of understanding what the effects of the problems are because they evolve at different points in time. And so that pointed us to a different method, which was we have to look at what's called the time domain. Can we look at the signal and break it up into what's arriving first and what's arriving a little bit later and a little bit later and a little bit later from the reflections and do our analysis in that domain? And that mm-hmm. was the first breakthrough in analyzing what's going on in room acoustics. After that, we discovered something that we rediscovered, something that people already knew, which was if you just measure in one spot, you're really not capturing the problems that we hear. The problems are distributed around the listening area, and so we had to find a way to measure at multiple spots and then combine those measurements, because in the end you have just one equalizing filter that you can create for each loudspeaker. So you have to combine the measurements in multiple points, but you have to do it in a different way. In the past, people have tried that, and they simply took an average. And as you know, when you take an average of five or six things, what you're doing is you're adding them all up and dividing by five or six, which means you're giving each one of your measurements equal importance.
Mm.
But in reality, the problems in the room are not equally distributed. Some of them are much more important than others, especially the ones at low frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second innovation that led to MultiQ was a way of applying the proper weighting to the most important problems spatially first and less weighting to the least important, so that when you make a filter, the power of that filter for room correction is applied first where it counts. If you have an infinite amount of processing power, you could just brute force it and apply lots of power everywhere. But as you know, that doesn't happen in modern DSP chips because we have to share the resources with other processes in the receivers. And so we had to optimize for that.
Which, of course, processors are becoming more powerful day by day almost. I mean, certainly each generation, you increase the processing power, the bandwidth, the storage capacity. So one would think that with each generation, things get better and better.
Yes, that's true. If we compare just between today and where we were in 2004, there's almost been a factor of two increase in processing power. Now, remember, Moore's law applies to computer processors. It doesn't quite apply as fast to the DSP chips that are inside receivers. They still grow, of course, but not quite as fast.
That's very interesting. I was going to mention Moore's law as basically saying, I think Gordon Moore, a co-founder of Intel, originally stated it as the number of transistors within a computer chip, I guess he was referring to microprocessors, doubles every 18 to 24 months.
Yes.
And by extension, right, the power increases by that amount. And in terms of computer chips, microprocessors, that has remained relatively true for the last, 30, 40 years.
That's right. In fact, computer processors are ahead of that. They're closer to 13 to 14 months doubling.
Wow.
But digital signal processors that are specialized for specific operations to process signals haven't kept up with that pace. They're still increasing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you couple that slower increase with the abundance of algorithms coming out from not just Odyssey, but everybody else who's inside receivers, and you can see the NASCAR-type logos on the front of the, the panels there.
That always strikes me as very
the
funny.
Competition, yes, the competition for it has come down to MIPS, available MIPS. And so we have to
millions of instructions per second.
Yes, that's right, millions of instructions per second. And so we have to fit within a certain budget. And to do that, there's a great deal of optimization that we've had to do to our algorithms to achieve that.
Where are we MIPS-wise with current DSPs? Is there any way to sort of specify that? I'm curious.
The high-end ones are, on the order of 400 to 500 MIPS today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of it depends on the type of architecture of the chip, but that's a rough number, which is, if you compare it to speeds, that's equivalent to 400 or 500 megahertz. If you compare it to speeds of computer chips, that's much lower, obviously.
Mm. I would think, it's very odd, I would think that something that was dedicated to a particular task would grow in power perhaps even faster than a general purpose chip, such as a microprocessor.
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult trade-off. It's dedicated to this task, and it's much better at processing stable signal streams like video and audio than the other chips are, but it comes at a cost, and that cost is lower processing speed.
Okay. And is that 500 MIPS floating point or fixed point?
Floating
point,
which is really a better way to do audio. Yes, it is. We don't always have the luxury of doing that. It depends on the device that we're in, but most receiver chips are floating point.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I talked to you about multi-Q in the past and how it works, you mentioned a process that I was fascinated by the name, and I would love for you to explain it, fuzzy clustering.
Yes.
It's a great name. I love that name. I don't know if it's, some marketing thing or if it really has some technical meaning, but...
No,
what the
I
heck is fuzzy clustering?
It relates to what I was talking about before. So, the way we process the measurements is the following: we take a bunch of measurements in the room, and then the problem is to find a way to combine them. And we don't want to do averaging, because if you just think of a simple example, let's say you have two measurements, and one of them in the main seat shows a peak at 100 hertz. And if you move over because of standing waves in the room, if you move over a couple of feet, the same measurement there will be probably showing a dip at 100 hertz. If you take the two and average them, the peak and the dip will cancel each other out, and the filter will say, oh, that's great, I don't have to do anything at 100 hertz.
Right.
So we had to then find a way to decide what to do at 100 hertz based on the information from all the measurements. And to do that, we use a method that first called clustering. So clustering says, I'm going to take each measurement and look at it as a mathematical pattern. It just has some wiggles and peaks and dips in it. And I'm going to compare it to every other measurement that I took and compare the patterns mathematically to see which ones are more similar than others. The ones that are more similar get put in a cluster, in a group. Cluster is a marketing word for group.
Okay.
And so we have a rule. If you're more similar to measurements 2 and 3, you're all going to be in the same cluster. And maybe measurement 4 is so different that it gets its own cluster, and so on. The tricky part comes, the fuzzy part. Typically, when you think of clusters, you're either in cluster 1 or cluster 2 or 3 or and so on. But in order to provide an additional layer of weighting of the acoustical problems, we allow the boundaries of the clusters to blur. So there's a probability involved. You're sort of in cluster 1 with an 80% chance, but sometimes 20% of the time you might be considered in cluster 2. That is the fuzzy logic part, where the boundaries between things are no longer hard, but are governed by laws of probability. And when you do that, you have this effect of, so from the 6 or 8 or 10 measurements that you take in your room, you end up with 3 or 4 clusters. And each of these clusters, by looking at the neighboring ones with the fuzzy clustering that I talk about, we create a representative response that says, this response best represents, with the right weighting, the problems of the measurements that were put in each of these clusters. So now it's like a pyramid. You're going from many measurements up to fewer by electing these representative responses. And then you repeat that process until eventually you end up with a single response that contains in it the appropriate weighting of what was found to be the problem in the space that you were measuring. So that is fuzzy clustering. It's based on applying fuzzy logic rules from a field of mathematics that uses probability to the measurements that are put into clusters.
Mm-hmm. And so that what you end up with then is a single corrective algorithm that presumably solves the problems in multiple listening positions in the room.
That's right. It solves them as best as it can by trying to manipulate many hundreds of control points or filter taps, as they're called, so that the response is shaped to the desired response. And by giving it that many degrees of freedom to wiggle, which is many, many more than what was done before. Typically, you have 10 or 13 bands of parametric EQ. Here, we're talking about up to 1,000 or more individual control points. They're not the same as bands, but it's the same principle. This is what you have to manipulate to shape your filter. That is much, much higher resolution, and therefore, you can achieve much better shaping of the desired response.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that the bands, the frequency bands themselves, are narrower than you would typically get with a manual graphic EQ or parametric EQ?
Sure. Yeah, the more points you have, the narrower the bands you get to control. So that's the higher resolution. Now, the tricky part there is, of course, the more bands you have, the more points, the processing power required to process a filter like that goes up as the number of points. And so you're going to quickly run out of MIPS, as we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So there was an additional layer of optimization that we had to do to avoid that problem. And that came from a combination of acoustics and psychoacoustics. We know from acoustics of especially small rooms that the biggest problems occur in the low frequencies, let's say below 200 hertz. So it's reasonable to assume that we should focus more computing power at those low frequencies. We also know that our mechanism of hearing on some level is spaced logarithmically in the frequency, on the frequency axis. So we have bands that determine our sensitivity of hearing, and these bands are not spaced evenly. They're spaced wider as you go to high frequencies and shorter, thinner as you go to lower frequencies. So the combination of those two things gave us a method for optimizing the filter computing power so that you get effectively the resolution of many thousands of points, but only using a few hundred points, and therefore keeping the computing lower.
Does the Fletcher-Munson curve also play an effect, which basically says that the human hearing system is less sensitive to low frequencies and high frequencies in terms of level or volume than it is to center frequencies in the 2 to 4K range?
Well, it does play an effect in another Odyssey technology that we've developed, but not in multi-Q. In multi-Q, we are assuming that you are calibrating for a reference level, which means that you are listening at the same level at which the content was mixed, and so there are no differences in that occur because of loudness. Of course, no civilian can listen at Hollywood mix levels. They are too high, and our surveys, our installers tell us that most people at home listen at between minus 10 and minus 20 on the master volume control instead of zero, which would be reference. And so there, yes, the loudness curves play a very big role, and for that reason, we had to develop the next technology to address that, which was dynamic EQ.
And that was my very next question.
Great lead-in, Scott.
Perfect, perfect. Yes, so here we are then with the next big development from Odyssey, which is dynamic EQ, and why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So going back to Tom, in 1977, believe it or not, he wrote a paper that was published in the Audio Engineering Society journal, and the title of the paper was Loudness, Use and Abuse. And it was a great title because basically he stood up in front of the Audio Engineering Society and told them all of the reasons why loudness controls in 1977 could not be used, that they were doing more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I don't know, many people may still remember them. Eventually, those controls disappeared from the front panels.
I certainly remember them. They basically tended to boost the bass, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. And if you look at the curves that determine how we perceive loudness, how loud something is as a function of frequency, you will find that we are the most sensitive in the mid-range frequencies around 2 to 4 kilohertz, mm-hmm. and we're a lot less sensitive in the low frequencies. And depending on how far down you turn the volume, we could be 50 or 60 dB less sensitive at 20 hertz. So the typical reaction was, well, we need to boost the bass. The problem was those curves, if you look at them, are not parallel. In other words, the lower down you go, the more peaked up they get at the low frequencies. And so you have to know what curve you're on in order to make the right adjustment. And those old controls just made a fixed bass boost.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right for one volume setting, but it was totally wrong for every other volume setting. And that was part of the problem. Most people eventually ended up turning it off because it was usually overcompensating. So the first problem was, by the way, everybody refers to the Fletcher-Munson curves. But in fact, those were developed by Fletcher and Munson at Bell Labs, trying to solve the problem of what happens to your response as you're listening to over headphones, over an earpiece to the telephone. They were working for the telephone company. It turns out that loudness curves are a little different in listening over loudspeakers in a room.
Oh, really? And I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, some adjustments had to be made, and there was some work done in that area since then, and we did some of our own experiments. So the curves are a little bit different from the traditional Fletcher-Munson, but basically the same concept. The benefit that we have today is that if we look at content like film, it is mixed to a standard. And so we know the sound pressure level at which the film content was mixed and in the studio, in the dubbing stage. That means the decision that the mixer was making about the balance between low and high frequencies was made at a known playback level.
Which is otherwise known as reference level, which is quite loud, actually.
Yes, that's right. It's quite loud. And so we have that as a starting point. We know what was intended to be the balance. We also know today where the user has their volume control because it is a digital volume control and it talks to the microprocessor and tells us where it is.
Hmm.
We also know, because Multi-Q has been doing its job, that in addition to doing room correction, Multi-Q also sets the trim levels for your loudspeakers so that when the volume control is at zero, every loudspeaker is playing at reference level. So we know the sound pressure level in the room. We know the desired sound pressure level of the content. And the only thing that was remaining to do was we had to build a real-time loudness analyzer for the content itself. Because if you look at a passage of film, it has some soft parts and some loud parts, and these are changing as you move along. If I turn the volume down, the soft parts fall on a different curve, loudness curve, than do the loud parts, and therefore they need a different amount of psychoacoustic correction. And we have to do that in real time to fine-tune the content based on the volume setting. So that there's a real-time process. It's not a fixed curve in dynamic EQ that looks at the content. That's why we call it dynamic EQ.
So
the processing power that the chips give us allow us to have a real-time loudness meter in every channel that...
Well, looks like we've lost the video feed there somehow. Whoops. Burke, any thought on that?
We're calling him back right now.
Okay.
Just dropped.
Well, we did get an audio question, which I was about to ask Chris. And while we're waiting to get him back, there was actually a video question, which I wasn't going to answer because Chris is an audio guy. But while we're waiting, I'll answer it. And the question was, what is the current state of the art in projectors that do not need lamp replacements, which really means LED projectors? Are they bright enough to use in a large, albeit windowless, room? My answer is yes, absolutely. I've seen LED projectors on relatively large screens that look fabulous. Now, you really do need a black hole room to do it very well because they aren't as bright as UHP lamps, but they certainly can produce a beautiful image on a relatively large screen as long as you have a really black room. And that also means dark walls, dark neutral walls, dark ceiling, dark floor, and really no windows. I've looked at the digital projection projector. I know home theater editor Shane Bettner has looked at the Runco and Vivitech LED projectors. And I'm certainly hoping to get some more in as we see more of them enter the market because I'm very excited by this technology, not having to replace lamps, being much cooler, not generating as much heat, in other words, aside from the fact that they're really cool. So, yes, there's Chris. Hey, welcome back.
Hey, back.
Not sure what happened there, but you want to just finish what you were saying about dynamic EQ?
So, with dynamic EQ, we're monitoring the level in real time and making adjustments based on the content. We know the master volume level and making adjustments to the frequency response based on that. Mm-hmm. And the final thing we found was we actually brought a bunch of mixers into our university lab and had them listen at low volumes. And they'd never done that, by the way. They always listen at reference. They were never given a volume.
I've got a friend who's a mixer, and his license plate on his car is loud mixer, and he's now extremely hard of hearing.
Yeah, that is a problem. But when we turned it down, almost all of them said, hey, what happened to the surrounds? And that led us to do a little bit more investigation. It turns out our perception of loudness is not the same all around us. When we turn the volume down, things drop off in front, but they drop off faster behind us. And so an adjustment needs to be made to the level of the surround speakers so that we maintain the sense of envelopment that the surround mix is intended to give us. So that's the final thing that Dynamic EQ does, is it adjusts the surround level tied to the volume control so that you always have constant surround level.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, this is all very interesting, and we're going to continue in a moment with a listener question, actually. But before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you might consider downloading is All Things Firesign, written and narrated, even more important, by the Firesign Theater, one of my all-time favorite comedy troupes. I actually performed with them at the Ojai Music Festival in 1979. And I saw a performance a couple of years ago, and they haven't lost a step in all that time. So I can highly recommend this audiobook, which should be even more hilarious than the printed version, since they're actually... reading it with undoubtedly hilarious results. To download this audiobook or another of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. Okay, Chris Kyriakakis is with us from Odyssey, and we have a listener question from Virgil, who asks, if you have an Onkyo 9.2 receiver, but you only have five speakers and one sub, will Odyssey correct for the addition of four speakers and a second sub? I assume he means if you were to then add four more speakers later.
Yes, that's right. He's talking about Odyssey DSX, Dynamic Surround Expansion.
Which is another thing I want to get to, yes.
Yeah, so we can talk about that in a minute. But to answer his question directly, yes, if you're running Odyssey on any system, it will correct any of the speakers connected. We wouldn't be Odyssey otherwise and let you put up speakers that are not corrected. So, yes.
Great. One fellow person who does not identify themselves with the handle says, sound algorithms are for all humans, but are not sound curves, hearing sensitivity and frequencies and so on, different for race or national origin? Good question.
It's not clear that race or national origin matter, but there are differences. If he's talking about the loudness curves, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The loudness curves that we see are, of course, average curves across large tested populations. So, yes,
right.
There are error bars associated with them, absolutely. So
yeah,
if we had a way to measure each individual, we would get even better results, but we have to go with the average curves.
I could imagine in the future an AVR that somehow managed to measure your particular sensitivity, the curve for each individual, and then do some fuzzy clustering on that, perhaps.
An interesting idea, Scott.
That's your next product right there. I can tell already. Okay, so tell us a little bit about DSX, which is certainly another of the technologies, one of the most recent technologies put out by Odyssey, and certainly one of the ones that is most fascinating to me.
Sure. So going back to the lab that we've had at USC, for many years, Tom and I were looking at the question of if the gods of loudspeakers gave you more, where would you put them and how many would you need? And Tom had started talking about this more than 10 years ago. And after some experimentation and thinking reading the literature in acoustics and perception, we found that the next significant improvement beyond 5 turned out to be 10. Now, that's a great marketing thing as well, because 10.2, as we called it, is twice 5.1. but it did really make the next noticeable difference in spatial reproduction of sound, in realistic spatial reproduction.
So if you go from 5.1 to 7.1, you're not really gaining that much. I've always believed that.
That's right. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because I think the audio industry made a huge mistake with 7.1, which I'll get to you in 1 minute. It's after mm-hmm. I talk about the reasons. Where would you put channels? So the way we talk about this is, if you gave 10 speakers to one of our engineering students at USC, the immediate response would be, well, there's 360 degrees in a circle. I have 10 speakers. I'm going to put one every 36 degrees.
Mm.
Unfortunately, that doesn't take into account acoustics or psychoacoustics, human perception. And what was found by research, not just by us, but many other people, is that the reflections from side walls in the best concert halls in the world come from a particular angle. It turns out to be 55 degrees, plus or minus a few degrees. And those halls have a characteristic that delivers reflected sound that arrives from that angle and a little bit later than the direct sound. And it differentiates them from other halls that are more square in nature, where that doesn't hold true. So the shoebox-type halls, like the Boston Symphony Hall or the Leipzig Gewandhaus, Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, all have this approximate direction of reflections that gives a huge impression of a wider hall and a very pleasing sound of soundstage.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a clue. It turns out to be a human preference for reflected sound to enhance the soundstage in front. Reflected sound from the sides arriving with a modified frequency response and a little bit later than the direct sound is from this angle, gives the impression of a much wider soundstage. So the first direction to put these is at 55 or 60 degrees.
Scott, we're going to have to call back.
Yeah.
Chris, we're
having some technical difficulties here, so I guess they're going to have to call you back. Too bad. We've got a couple of more reader questions, which is great. I thank you all for posting them. And we'll get them on with Chris as soon as we get him back. Sorry for the technical difficulties there. We did a test earlier today, and things were working just fine. Jim Dandy, in fact. But we got a question here about multiple subs, which is a really great question. And question about...
He's back.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Oh, we still have that problem. I didn't know if it was just me or if it was in the system.
I can hear you guys. It's fine. Is it...
How is it for you, Burke? Testing? Chris, say something for me.
It sounds very distorted, actually.
Yeah, huh. I don't know what's going on there.
That's strange. I hear you
it's
very
gone away.
Clearly.
Oh, it's gone away. It's gone. The gremlin has left.
Ah, good. Okay. Let's begin.
Okay, so anyway, so you were saying that the concert halls, the best concert halls give you a really nice reflection at about 55 degrees. So if you put speakers at about 60 degrees, plus or minus from the center line, that's actually a really good place to put some extra speakers if you've got some extra speakers to put someplace.
That's right. And so the idea is not to simulate the sound of a concert hall, but it was the effect that those reflections have is to give you a perception of a wider space than the one that you're sitting in. And that's mm-hmm. always a good thing to achieve in especially a small listening room. So that was the first most important direction. The second most important direction to add speakers is the height. If you, going back to the classical analogy, an orchestra sits on the stage, there's a proscenium, a very high ceiling above them, and sound that reflects from there and arrives to your ears a little bit later gives you a sense of depth of stage. And mm-hmm. so processing DSX, Odyssey DSX processes that sound and delivers two additional channels from the height to give you this sensation of depth of stage. Mm-hmm. And so what you've noticed is I've described four speakers that are being added to the front hemisphere. And that is very important because human perception studies have shown that the resolution of human hearing, the ability to know where a sound is in space, is much, much more defined in the front than it is in the back. We're actually not very good at telling the direction of sound in the back. We know it's behind us somewhere, but we can be off by 10 or 20 degrees before we notice that there's a problem. And so getting back to your original question, of course, what did the audio industry do is let's add two more speakers, but let's put them in the back where human perception matters the least. It was an unfortunate decision, in my opinion. Those speakers are much better used in the front.
Which is what DSX then addresses. Of course, there's no content with front width channels, as they're called, or front height channels. So DSX has to actually derive them.
That's right. And just to be clear, there's no content for the back surround channels in 7.1 either. All movies are produced in 5.1. There's not a single movie that's produced in 7.1. The DVDs, they're the Blu-rays that are now touting 7.1, are synthesized. That content is made after the movie was made, and it's through some other method, either remixed or processed through some kind of matrix, and then coded on the disc.
I did see a note this morning movies, in my email yet. About Toy
so,
Story.
Yes,
Toy Story 3.
We synthesize.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think you've lost me again.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, are you there?
I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, good. I got a news item in my email this morning that touted Toy Story 3 as being the world's first movie with actual 7.1 discrete soundtrack in the theater.
That's right. It is the first one, and Dolby announced this the discrete 7.1 system a few months ago, and Toy Story 3 will be the first one to have it.
But again, they're putting these speakers in the back, which is the least important place to put them.
They are. It's unfortunate, but at least they're establishing the need for more speakers, and then we'll eventually get them in the right place, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Got a couple more questions for you. F Loop asks, Floyd Toole indicated on a previous podcast that multiple subwoofers are required to get even bass response across multiple listening positions. What is your opinion on this, and do your products address this solution?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Driving the low frequencies in a room from different points allows you to basically excite slightly different shifted standing waves. And so the peaks and dips don't all fall in the same locations and don't add on top of each other. So yes, driving with multiple subs is a good thing. And anytime Odyssey is given the chance to address these subwoofers individually, we do. It really depends on the implementation that the manufacturer puts together. So the available processing power and how many subwoofers they allow us to measure individually is what determines whether we can do it or not. The algorithm itself scales. And so in our standalone sub-equalizer, for example, or the one made by SVS, which is the consumer version of it, the AS-EQ1, you can calibrate two subwoofers individually. And now many of the new receivers that are coming out this year from our licensees also do that. In the past, many manufacturers would give you two subwoofer outputs on the back, but they were actually Y-corded internally. They were playing the same signal. This is starting to change. And so we can calibrate them individually, yes.
You mentioned Sub-EQ, which is another product of Odyssey, and you said SVS is making that available to consumers. The Odyssey product is, I guess, for pro audio, right?
That's right. It's for installers, people who use the Odyssey installer kit had been using it for the sound equalizer or for running Multi-Q Pro, which is a more advanced version that runs on your laptop and lets an installer calibrate home theater receivers that are compatible with Multi-Q Pro. The Sub-EQ from Odyssey is a product in that line.
Now, will it let you do more than two? Because I know that Floyd has often recommended four as being an optimum number of subs.
Yeah, this one, no, it's limited to two. And that's obviously for cost reasons of hardware. You're welcome to put two of them and do four. But this particular box takes up to two subwoofers.
And we should mention that in addition to Odyssey technology being available in consumer receivers and TVs and so on, there is also this second branch of your product line, which is available only through custom installers. So if you are fortunate enough to be able to hire a custom installer to build a theater for you, you can, in fact, have them install these Odyssey products, which I assume are probably more powerful or in some way more, they have something more to offer than what's in the consumer products?
Yeah, so the installer program has two parts. One is the standalone sound equalizer box that we sell, which is an 8-channel in, 8-channel out processor. And that's intended for systems that have separate. So you have a pre-pro and an amplifier that sits between them and lets you calibrate, lets the installer calibrate the theater using our software. The more popular version is the one where a number of the upper lines, the upper parts of the line of each of our manufacturer have been enabled with Multi-Q Pro. So you can run the built-in Multi-Q, or you can hire an installer for your Denon, your Onkyo, your NAD, your Marantz, receiver, Integra, to come to your house and calibrate that receiver using the Odyssey Pro software.
Right. Our own Darth Emma has a question. She has an Onkyo receiver with Odyssey, and she has a 7.1 speaker setup. So her question is, do you recommend with seven main speakers, putting the extra two beyond 5.1 to the height or the wide positions? Which of those two, if you had to choose, is the more important one to put your speakers
in? The wide. There's no question it should be the wides. It is a much more important and perceivable improvement than the heights. So the recommended order is wides first. If you get permission for two more speakers, heights second. And if you live alone, you can put the back surrounds. Meaning permission is granted from the higher authority to add more speakers.
As you said, marketing-wise, the 10.2 or the 7.1 or 9.1 are also really good for the industry because it means you have to buy more speakers.
That's right. We didn't get too many complaints from the speaker makers when we pushed that.
Aaron asks a somewhat sensitive question, and I will ask it, but I understand that it's sensitive. He asks, how does this acoustic improvement compare to the Bose technology, which has been impressive, he says. And I could imagine improvement that would they would make to his B&W speakers. Do you even address competitors' products?
It's probably better not to. I can speak technically as from what we know to be the difference. I'm not sure which Bose. Is he talking about the Bose Adapt IQ technology?
He doesn't say. He went on to say, how do they sound? The driver is less important to that group than the use of the chassis as a way to augment the sound. I'm afraid I don't quite understand that question.
No, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Does Bose have some sort of a room
Bose
correction?
They do. They have I think it's 5 measurement positions. It's called Adapt IQ. It's basically an implementation of the traditional way of equalizing, which is capture in 5 points using some kind of noise, pink noise, I think.
It is Adapt IQ that he's talking about.
Yeah. So you measure in the frequency domain, not in the time domain. You do averaging, and so that gives equal weighting. And so there are some issues there. And the final result, I believe, is a parametric equalizer with however many bands they can fit. So technically, those are the differences.
We won't comment on which one sounds better because I know what your answer to that will be. And certainly you have other competitors. You have, let's see, who else is out there? I know Yamaha's doing a proprietary thing. Pioneer's doing a proprietary thing. I don't know if Dolby is.
No, Dolby's not.
Dolby's not.
Yamaha
okay.
and Pioneer have their own versions. So I guess we don't consider them competitors because they're not out licensing to others. It just means that so far those companies have decided not to go with Odyssey.
Aaron said that his system sounded rather wretched before Adapt IQ. So I wouldn't be surprised.
There's no question. One of the first tests that we did probably 8 years ago, we didn't use Adapt IQ, but we used a typical parametric equalizer, comparing it to other things. Every single person in that listening panel preferred an equalized system over a non-equalized system. There's no question that there's an improvement. The question is, can you make much bigger improvements to really solve the acoustical problems? There's no question you can improve sound, especially from small speakers in challenged enclosures.
Right, exactly. One last thing I wanted to ask you about is in fact now related to dynamic EQ, which we talked about earlier, which is dynamic volume.
Yes.
And I have to say that this is, to me, a godsend because, as we've talked about on the show before, the difference in volume levels between television shows and commercials, or even between one channel, television channel and another, can appear quite dramatic. And actually what happens, as I understand it, is it's not that the volume level per se changes so much, but that the dynamic range of the television program is quite a bit wider. It can get a lot softer than the commercials, which are dynamically compressed so that the entire commercial is at the maximum volume, essentially.
Yeah.
But it sounds it's a lot louder.
Yeah, it's actually a combination of those. The dynamic range of commercials is compressed, and they're boosted dramatically in average level. And so it's kind of a double whammy. But it's not just the commercials. The problem is you're watching soft dialogue, and then explosions happen within the movie. Or you switch channels and there's something else loud happening. So we set out to address this again by looking at what had been done in the past. And traditionally, this problem was addressed by putting some kind of audio compressor on the path. And a compressor basically looks at the input level and says, if it's too loud, turn it down, and if it's too soft, turn it up.
That's more like an automatic gain control, right, rather than a compressor.
That's right. It might have a curve to it, a nonlinear curve, but it's basically that. And the problem with those types of methods is that they only react with one timing. And so if the changes between soft and loud and back to soft are happening at different timings than what this block is used to doing, it gets caught moving in the opposite direction. And then it says, oh no, I have to switch. And it starts to switch, and then it starts to switch back. And that causes an audible artifact, which is called pumping.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear the voices going up and down, singing. It's very audible if you have a vocalist and a bass line, a bass guitar or something that is coming in pretty loud. It modulates the loudness of the voice being perceived because of these AGC type controls pumping in and out. So we said there's got to be a different way to do this. And the way we addressed it is we took a bunch of mixers, professionals and student mixers from the USC school, and brought them into the lab and had them basically listen to movies with their hand on the master fader and pretending as if their kids were sleeping next door, and told them adjust as needed. They spent hours and hours. We collected about 10 terabytes of data doing this, and we electronically monitored what they were doing to the console fader. So we knew the adjustments. The human knows what to do. We all know what to do with the remote control. We just don't want to do it all the time.
Right.
So from that data, we found that there were patterns. Sometimes they weren't changing it at all. Other times they were changing very fast, other times very slowly. And we looked at the patterns between what they were doing and what was happening in the content. And from those correlations, we came up with a reverse engineering of human action, of human brain, saying, this is how we do it. Now let's make an algorithm that mimics that. And that's what dynamic volume does. It uses a buffer to look ahead half a frame before the audio is played, makes all its decisions, and then reacts with the appropriate timing so that it's never caught going in a direction that would cause pumping.
Doesn't it also take frequency into account?
In what sense?
Well, I thought, as I recall, dynamic volume and dynamic EQ were related or connected in some way.
Yes, that's right. So when dynamic volume is deciding to make a change to turn the volume down, then, of course, dynamic EQ has to kick in to make sure that the frequency response is preserved. So, absolutely.
Of course.
Absolutely, they work together.
Yeah. Yeah, and it sounds like dynamic volume was derived again from a large sample of humans, just like the loudness curves that are used in dynamic EQ were derived as well.
That's right. We had a number of people. Yes, we had many people come in and listen and be recorded, basically watching movies. It was a great summer job.
One last reader, listener question. Dr. Fate asks, what are your thoughts on wood cone speakers? Have you ever listened to wood cone speakers?
No, I'm afraid I've not.
I did a couple of times. There are some ways of doing that, wood cones. One is wood pulp, and there's plenty of speakers that do that. JVC introduced actual veneers of wood. I mean, actual solid, very thin pieces of wood shaped into cones, which they soaked in sake.
Yes. I could just imagine that discovery. I've been to Japan many times, and I know I'm sure the engineer was sitting somewhere late at night after a few drinks and decided to soak some wood.
Yes, in the sake that he was also drinking.
Yes, maybe the coaster on the bar. I don't know.
Yeah. No, but, sadly, what I heard very good.
I don't have experience with them.
Right. Okay, well, that's fine. Because here we are. We've reached the end of our hour together, and I really appreciate it. Chris Kyriakakis of Odyssey, thanks a lot for all your wonderful insights.
Thanks very much, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Be sure to check out Odyssey's website at odyssey.com. That's AUDYSSEY.com. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com, and you can email me with questions or suggestions for podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. You can also follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, I'll be traveling to the CEA line shows in New York, so I won't be doing a podcast on Monday. 2 weeks from now, my guest geek is scheduled to be Joe Dappolito, famed speaker designer. So I'm sure he'll have a lot of interesting things to say about how speakers are designed and how best to make a speaker. So until then, geek out.